Lambellamy. But she recognized it from the bottles other girls had smuggled into their dormitory. She sipped it and tried not to wrinkle her nose. It was horribly bitter.
"Have you ever had wine before?"
Cedric asked conspiratorially.
"I was 12 when I tried it for the first time. Didn't have a taste for it then either."
"No, I haven't. It's..." She didn't want to sound rude and risk ruining her charade. "It's nice."
"I wouldn't tell your parents if I were you."
"Why not?" He scooted closer to her until their legs touched.
"That's how parents are. They won't like how fast you're growing up."
N had always been a good liar. She'd lied to Levi about the vaults. She'd lied to her mother's house staff about how she was spending her summer. She'd lied over and over to her classmates about where lords always travelled. But there was no lie as disgusting as this one. Because the truth of it wasn't that she'd been selfish, or that she'd run away to the City of Sin, but that, probably many times before, there'd been a real girl who sat where she sat, who smiled as she smiled. This game was a familiar one to Cedric. She was suddenly grateful for the vial in her pocket. Before, she was going to poison Cedric Torren because she had no choice. Now she was poisoning him for the girls who hadn't known better. For all the girls fed to the wolves. She was still scared. She was still terrified. Cedric wasn't simply a predator. He was one of the most powerful people in the North Side. He was a beast wearing a man's skin. But she was also decided. There was no shame in poisoning him.
"Shall we go?" he asked, offering his arm.
She took it, her wine in her other hand. "We shall." In the lobby, three lines waited outside the theatre. According to the posters on the wall, the dancing show was only one of the many varieties that St. Morse offered.
"Where do you take your dance lessons?"
Cedric asked as they took a place in the back. "I'm looking for a troupe, actually."
"That's awfully ambitious of you. Looking to dance here, maybe?"
He took another sip of his wine. She'd better hurry, or soon his glass would be empty, and she would miss her chance. She didn't know what the Omerta would do to her if she failed, but she refused to die in the city. "Yes, I'd love to dance here," she responded. "But I don't think Ms. Augustine wants to give me the job."
"Why not? You're an excellent dancer, though I suppose she might want someone older."
"My split talent has nothing to offer her, and Salters are a volt a dozen in the casinos." She spoke matter-of-factly, as if she'd been in the city for more than a day. She must have sounded convincing, because he squeezed her hand comfortingly, and N felt weary with nausea.
"She doesn't know the talent she's missing. But you wouldn't want to work here anyway."
"Why not?"
"Because the Augustines are the cruelest family in the North Side," he said, dropping his voice to a whisper. They were, after all, surrounded by Bianca's patrons. "Their blood talent is Omerta's, an unbreakable oath, like a swear of fealty and silence. Bianca is no better than a glorified street lord."
Unbreakable? The word echoed in her mind, unraveling her, shattering her. It couldn't be true. Before his words could fully sink in, she pushed them away. She had a job to finish. She and Cedric reached the ticket booth.
"Do you mind holding this for a moment, Emma?"
Cedric handed her his drink and rummaged through his coat pockets, then turned to talk to the ticket salesman. N hardly believed her luck. This was her chance. She turned around and quickly slipped the vial from her pocket. She didn't hesitate. She dumped the poison into Cedric's glass. It was so easy. She'd done it, just like that. Returning the vial to where it was before, she waited for Cedric to finish purchasing the tickets. Her heart beat faster with a mixture of fear and exhilaration. When he finished, brandishing two blue Admit Ones, Cedric plucked his wine glass out of N's hand.
"To the show," he said,
leading her in with his arm around her waist. The theatre was dark. A blue curtain draped over the stage, and a single spotlight shone at its centre. There must have been over 500 audience members already present, not counting the few in balconies along the walls. They took their seats in one of the side rows by the front. The tickets, she realized, must have been quite expensive. The piano tapped out a light, staccato tune, and the audience quieted in anticipation. Gradually, the spotlight faded. Cedric took a sip. When he didn't gag or convulse or immediately vomit, N realized the poison might not take effect for a while. She also realized that she didn't feel even a twinge of guilt. She didn't care. He was a contemptible man. The curtains rose. Cedric Torin placed his hand on her knee and smiled triumphantly. But N had already won. N. When N returned to her apartment 2 hours after pouring the poison into Cedric's glass, the first thing she did was take a shower. She smelled of Cedric's vomit. However, more nauseating than that, she felt filthy with the city, with what she'd done and how little she cared. Unbreakable, Cedric had called the Omerta, but she refused to believe it. She couldn't be trapped within Vianca's grasp forever. N turned the water temperature up to steaming, but she didn't feel clean. She could still feel the heat of Cedric's gaze and the touch of his hand against her thigh. She had no other clothes to change into after bathing, so she put her slip back on, and over it the robe she found in the bathroom closet, embroidered with St. Morse's logo. Then she returned to the page she'd bookmarked in her guidebook. What if Vianca died? Would the Omerta break then? N intended to survive here, so she needed to learn more about Vianca, about New Reigns. She continued reading the guidebook's chapter about the city's organized crime. The topic shifted from the Augustine and Torin casino families to the street gangs. Although the families had control of the narcotics trade, the street gangs managed everything else. They'd divided the north side into territories and turned crimes into monopolies. She followed along, occasionally referring to her guidebook's map. Once upon a time, there had been dozens of gangs, but now there were three. The Scarhans. They were the largest gang, run by the slimy Eight Fingers, Raymond Kitamura, who N, despite all of her guidebook's warnings, had managed to meet during her first morning in the City of Sin. Not only did the Scarhans provide counterfeits and forgery services to the city, but they also operated the weapons trade. Their territory spanned throughout the factory district. You could spot a member by the scars that crisscrossed their palms and wrists. The Doves were the assassins, their territory known as the Deadman District. They dyed their hair white to match their lord, Ivory, who was credited with over 63 murders. No one had seen her face and lived. Perhaps she was so good that no one had ever seen her face at all. Last were the Irons, the gang of gamblers and cheats who called themselves consultants, and who occupied Old Town and the casino district like an infestation. They dealt in cards, ambition, and opportunity. Anything you could do, they could do better. They were the smallest gang, with the smallest paragraph in the guidebook. Levi wasn't even mentioned at all. Someone knocked on her door. N's stomach dropped, half expecting Vianca's woman again. She walked to the door and cracked it open, only to find it was Levi.
Hello, he said.
He looked pale. After all the night's stress, she'd utterly forgotten he would come for his vaults. I'm not dressed properly. He held up a bag.
That's fine. I brought your clothes. I figured you might need them.
She sighed and opened the door fully, even though she'd rather be alone and not deal with Levi's condescending smirks. He handed her the bag and she rummaged through it. The fabrics were colourful and flashy, very unlike her typical style. Are these from that collection of yours? She asked suspiciously.
Not this time. Jack swiped them from some clotheslines.
She grimaced as she wrapped an oversized sweater around herself. They'd have to do for now. She could buy her own clothes once she got paid. Beneath the clothes were food items, flour and eggs and other necessities. Her mood improved almost instantly. She was starving. She eagerly unloaded them onto the kitchen counter. To her delight, she now had all the right ingredients to make cookies. Dessert was such a simple comfort, but she nearly wanted to cry in appreciation. When she turned around to thank him, she realized he was no longer standing beside her. She heard him rummaging around in the living room.
What are you doing? She called.
Where did you find this trash?
Not even mentioned. He appeared in the kitchen, waving her guidebook.
Look at all the places the author says not to visit. Hundreds. We'll have to go on a tour, you and I. We only managed to hit up a few of them this morning.
He paused as she broke some eggs into a mixing bowl.
What are you making?
Cookies. I'll cook you to make them with me. En had spent a lot of her childhood keeping company with the staff, when Lords was travelling and she was lonely.
It's almost midnight.
I'm hungry. He shrugged and took a seat on the counter beside her.
You look flushed, missy. You go out on the town while I was working.
I stayed in, she lied. As she mixed in the flour, she gathered up her nerve to tell him what happened. Levi was Vianca's favorite, so he had to know about the Omerta. She wasn't allowed to speak its name or reveal the truth, but somehow she'd need to find a way around that. She needed to tell someone, and tolerable or not, Levi was the only person she had in New Reigns.
I read about Vianca in the guidebook. It mentioned the family blood talent.
When she tried to form the word, no breath would come out. She couldn't say it. Still, she persisted.
I forget what it's called.
Levi's face darkened.
I'm surprised they printed that in the guidebook.
Her chest tightened. The Omerta knew she was feeling for its cracks, searching for loopholes. But she needed to find a way to tell Levi. He was the only one in this city helping her. Maybe he could even convince Vianca to let her go.
Now that you're hired, keep as far away from Vianca as you can, he warned. Believe it or not, she's a woman you would rather have hate you than like you.
And you're her favorite, En thought, wondering what exactly that meant. She returned to the cookies, while Levi, now in a foul mood, stormed off into the living room. Every now and then she heard him groan something like,
They mentioned Jonas mucking Maccabees, but not me. Or, Vale founded the first street gang, not Havoc. Who wrote this shat's book anyway?
Then a few minutes passed in silence. En laid the cooling sugar cookies on the counter and walked into the living room, expecting to find him asleep. Instead, he was sitting up on the couch, turning over the empty vial of poison in his hands. En froze.
Black Maiden, he said grimly. It's Vianca's poison of choice.
Where did you find that? She stuttered.
I went looking. They don't mention Vianca's blood talent in the guidebook.
He nodded to it open on the table.
En, why do you have this poison?
There was an acute desperation in his voice, in his expression. He stepped close enough that she could smell his cologne, too close to avoid his gaze. En tensed beneath that look. She took a deep breath and tried to form the words, testing the limits of the Omerta, what she could say and what she could not.
Vianca Augustine is a monster, she managed carefully. And you knew that. So why did you bring me to her?
Her voice was full of accusation. She didn't mean that. Or maybe she did. He blanched as the realization settled in.
What kind of job did she give you?
Why would you bring me to her?
En hadn't realized how angry she was until she shouted the words.
You were supposed to help me!
She laid her hands on his chest and shoved him back.
You told me to trust you!
He looked as though she'd punched him.
I didn't know. How could I? Vianca can only give three.
He shuddered and didn't speak the word.
At any time. They're precious to her. I never would have guessed she'd give one to you. You have to believe me.
He sounded genuinely wounded, genuinely desperate. For her? No, it had to be something more. Then it dawned on her. Levi continued, his voice strained.
If I had suspected, I'd never...
You have one too, En whispered. That's why Raymond said you're her favorite.
His nostrils flared.
Of course I have one.
He turned away from her and paced around the living room.
As if I chose to start a scheme that was born to fail. I've been scrambling around for months trying to clean it up. Meanwhile, the irons are as good as broke. They can barely look at me anymore. I can barely look at myself anymore.
He stopped pacing, but he still never faced her.
I was supposed to be something. Instead, I'm hers.
His voice grew hoarse at that last word, as if he might also break down. He fiddled with something silver in his pocket. Is it truly unbreakable? En asked quietly. She couldn't tell who was supposed to be comforting whom. She didn't know what scheme he was talking about. He turned to look at her.
Yes, he whispered hoarsely. Unless she dies.
She gave him a questioning look.
I'm not a killer, no, he murmured. But oh, I would. But I can't. We can only pray someone else does.
Any lingering anger she had left disappeared. She'd never seen someone else's expression so perfectly reflecting her own. They were both trapped. And he hated Bianca. She could hear it in his every word. Leaving him to cool down for a moment, she brought in a plate of cookies from the kitchen. 6 for her, 2 for him. She sat on the couch, her knees against her chest, making herself small. She ripped a cookie in half and nibbled it from center to crust. Eating felt normal. She'd barely eaten all day. Levi sat opposite her in an armchair.
I'm sorry.
He said it like he meant it.
I'm so, so sorry.
I know. And she really did.
What did she make you do?
She didn't make me do anything. En moved on to her second cookie, her voice low and cold and unrecognizable. Initially she did. But by the end I wanted to. And I don't feel guilty in the least bit. I'd do it again. She paused to examine his reflection for any judgment, but his face was unreadable. Does that make me a bad person?
I suppose it depends on what it is you did, he said uneasily.
She braced herself for the Amerta's constrictions, but felt none. In Luckluster Casino, Cedric Torin is likely overturning his dinner, and he deserves it. Apparently, once the secrecy of the Amerta was broken, En could speak the truth freely. She sighed with relief. Levi froze while reaching for a cookie.
You poisoned Cedric Torin.
He's not dead, just sick. En shuddered. There was a childish pink dress. Bianca made me wear it, and it worked. Bianca dressed me up to send me to the slaughter. A long moment paused before he whispered.
Are you hurt?
I'm fine.
You're not crying.
I said I'm not hurt.
But you cried all morning.
I'm tired, she seized. And if he kept prodding her, she would cry. It wouldn't take much. She wasn't trying to be strong. She just didn't have it in her to be anything right now. She stood and grabbed the orb she'd left on the table earlier for Levi, thrusting it at him.
I'm not taking that, he said defiantly. It's my fault that she found you.
You said the irons were broke.
And that's my fault too.
So fix it. She shoved the orb into his chest.
Does she know that you're Alfaro's daughter?
He asked, and she shook her head.
Good. She can't know, ever.
He laid the orb back on her table.
I'm not taking it.
But
don't you get it? He yelled. She owns you. For as long as she's breathing, you're trapped in new reins. There's no way out. All those things you said earlier about wanting to return home in the fall, wanting to finish school. You'll be lucky if you ever see Bellamy again. You'll be lucky if you make it out of the city alive.
The walls of the room suddenly felt smaller, closer, and at last En began to cry.
I...
He blinked at her as if seeing her for the first time.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to yell.
Slowly, hesitantly, he moved closer to her as her shoulders heaved and took her in his arms. His touch was warm. En almost slid away, but truthfully she welcomed the comfort, even from him. She had no one else.
I've never met one of her others, he murmured. I've always been alone.
I want to go home.
I know.
I want to find Lords. She'd never needed her mother as much as she did in this moment. Missing her felt like missing something vital in her chest. It ached as she steadied her sobs.
I promise we will, he said.
She clung to his words like a life raft. But what if Bianca gives me another assignment? She asked.
Then you do it. That's all you can do.
He let her go, and she pulled away from him and wiped her nose.
Tomorrow night we'll go to the Sotrel. We'll learn what we can about lords.
She nodded. It was a start. She picked up the orb and handed it to him one more time. I want you to have it. He took it, though she could tell it hurt him to do so.
A promise, N.
Her name sounded strange on his lips. He'd always called her Missy.
I'm going to help you. We're in this together, you and I.
She smiled weakly. They were, in more ways than one. As he opened the door to leave, she asked, What were you talking to Cedric about? I saw you speaking earlier, in the Trop's room. He paused and looked back at her for a moment, his expression perfectly blank.
Nothing, he said. We were only talking about a card game.
Before N could ask another question, Levi was already closing the door behind him.
Day 2. If you must visit, reader, then I implore you, remain only on the south side. Do not cross the Brint. Do not believe their smiles. Do not stray into their lairs. Or you may never come out. The City of Sin. A guidebook. Where to go and where not to. Levi. In an abandoned park in Old Town, Jack Mardlin leaned against a wrought-iron fence, his newsboy cap tilted down over his face. A briny morning mist hung in the air from last night's rain. Everything was dark. It was perpetually dark in Old Town. The buildings were made of glossy black stone, their spires and archways casting barbed shadows into the alleys. It all looked and smelled like a grotto. Jack was a mere silhouette in the mist, still and quiet. Levi might not have recognized him if not for the signature gray aura encircling his friend's body. It was light and smelled of linen, and Levi felt himself relax from its familiarity, like returning home after a long day. Levi tapped him on the shoulder, and Jack opened one eye. It was gray. Everything about Jack seemed gray and colorless, except for the red card tattoos on his arms and the faded scars beside them.
"Hello, Levi."
He yawned and crossed his heart.
"Long night? I had a shift."
Jack worked as a bouncer at a gambling den called the Houndstooth, a few blocks from St. Mawes. The den's owner was one of the Iron's oldest clients. Unlike the other gangs, which operated on crime and on New Rain's constant appetite for sin of all sorts, the Irons appealed to only a single vice: greed. They worked as contractors. Every few months, Levi selected a new gambling establishment and promised the owner that, if they hired his kids, he could raise their profits by 20% in 3 months. First, Levi brought in the card dealers, his expert cheats. Then he brought in the bouncers, the actors, the bartenders. He could sweeten every pot and rig every game. He had his consulting down to an art, and all he asked for in return was 15% of any growth. It was a deal very few could refuse.
"You look like you had a long night too," Jack said.
Levi rubbed his eyes wearily. He'd lain awake for hours last night, replaying his vision from the black and white hallway, revisiting the moment he'd held N and promised her he'd do the impossible. Then, around 5 in the morning, he'd pounded on Bianca's door to let her know exactly what he thought about N's new permanent position in her empire, only to learn that Bianca was gone for the day, out of town at some monarchist rally, preparing for a hopeless campaign for the November Senate election. Typical.
"Cedric Torrin brought me a gift last night," Levi explained.
He probably shouldn't have said it. Worries had a way of undoing his friend. But he needed to tell someone. He hadn't told N last night. Hadn't had a chance to tell Bianca this morning. And he needed some of the burden lifted off his shoulders.
"I wouldn't accept a gift from the Torrens if it was a killer vault tied with a ribbon," Jack said seriously. "What did Cedric give you?"
Levi pulled the shadow card out of his pocket. Jack paled, then snatched it from Levi's hands and turned it over, running his thumb across the metallic silver back.
"This is some serious muck. He didn't invite you, did?" "No. That's a warning."
The invitation card was the Fool, not the Tower. An invitation was a misnomer. The Fool card warned you of your upcoming execution. Upcoming as in immediately.
"A warning about what?"
"The investments. He said I have 10 days.
9 days now."
10 days? Jack croaked. You'll think of something. You always do."
Jack had always had too much faith in Levi, starting from the first day they'd met. Levi had been 12, crouched in an alley off Trop Street. He'd worn all black and kept his face covered, as was the signature look of Vale, a legend of the North Side, and Levi's hero. And he'd dealt out a deck of cards, goading passers-by with a game of 50-50 chances. But no one had stopped. They'd all recognized him and his cons by then.
"How would you like to make 100 volts today?"
Levi had asked Jack as he walked by. Even then, Jack was big. Not tall, he'd never been tall, but in his shoulders, in his build. The sort of strong that could have been concealed. He looked like a card Levi might want up his sleeve. Jack tapped Levi's near-empty orb jar with his boot.
"That's big talk. I aimed low."
They'd earned 200 volts, and they'd spent them all in one night, feasting and drinking at a lousy cabaret. So they met up again the next day. Soon it was every day, a new place, new con, new spoils. It lasted for 1 year, until Levi met Bianca, and Jack met a drug called Lullaby.
"Did you get a vision or something?"
Jack whispered.
"Ain't the shadow card supposed to be jinxed?"
"Nah, nothing like that,"
Levi lied, because Jack was already pulling out his creed, the necklace he wore that was a symbol of the old faith. Not many believed anymore. The misers had perpetuated its stories for their own gain, and after the revolution, the wickheads had declared the faith illegal. If Levi told Jack about the hallway and the graveyard, Jack wouldn't sleep for a week, and he'd spend the next few days quoting Levi verses from some text Jack couldn't even read himself. Jack rubbed the creed, which looked like an intricate knot in the shape of a diamond, between his fingers.
"Speaking of warnings, do we have anything to give Chez?"
Jack asked.
"More than, you know, the usual."
Lately the usual hadn't been much. Levi could manage to give him and the other Irons only the minimum at the last few weekly meetings.
"We don't collect from the dens for a few more days,"
Levi reminded Jack. It was the only excuse he could offer. Ever since the investment scam began to crumble, Levi hadn't been able to run the Irons like he used to, and they were falling apart. The minimum wasn't going to cut it much longer. It wasn't enough. And it killed him. Membership in a gang was more than a simple contract. It was an oath. Once you swore to a lord, they had power over you. Nothing unbreakable, like an Omerta, but a power that carried orders down a chain of command and prevented the gang's circle of trust from being violated. There was magic to an oath, and even if Levi didn't understand it, he respected it. Everyone on the streets did. They'd sworn Levi their loyalty, and he'd promised them more. If not greatness, if not wealth, then at least roofs over their heads and dinner in their stomachs. N had given him 1,000 volts last night, volts she thought were going to help the Irons. And Levi wished they were, but he needed them. They brought him 1,000 volts closer to paying Cedric. He'd be no good to the Irons if he was dead. 9 more days. All he needed was to survive the next 9 days. Then the Irons would go back to being the richest gang in the city. Then Levi could finally give his kids what they deserved. Levi checked his watch.
"We need to get going."
Jack walked beside him, his shoulders slumped with weariness.
"You haven't said anything about that missy you were with yesterday. N something?"
Levi would rather not involve Jack in all that muck, not if he could help it. The monarchists were a dangerous lot.
"I got her a job at St. Morse."
Guilt simmered in his stomach as he remembered where exactly that job had led N. He had admittedly thought her a bit snobbish when they first met, but he wouldn't wish Vianca's omerta on anyone. Had he even suspected Vianca would take interest in N that way, he would never have brought her near St. Maur's.
"You were supposed to help me," she yelled at him. "You told me to trust you."
Levi had failed her in the worst way. At the start, finding Alfero for her had been a way to save himself. And since Cedric had given him a shadow card, it meant salvation now more than ever. But since last night, it was also more than that. It was about N's forgiveness. It was about making things right. He'd originally thought N wouldn't last more than a night in New Rains, but he'd been wrong about her. Cedric had terrified Levi down to his very core, and N had poisoned him, the wolf of the North Side, and she felt remorseless. No, she wasn't what he'd expected at all. Jack snorted.
"A job doing what?" "I told Vianca she was an acrobat. Think you could get me a free ticket to the next show? I'll need a good laugh."
Jack kicked an empty beer bottle across the street. It clunked loudly. Too loudly. This section of Old Town was lifeless except for them. Then footsteps thumped through the silence. Chez strutted out from the alley next to the old church, Muncy following close behind. Chez was scowling, which had lately become as permanent a feature of his face as his protruding brow zone and sharp sliver of a nose. He saluted Levi, quickly and haphazardly. Muncy, however, brightened the moment she saw him and didn't hesitate to cross herself. Like most kids in the North Side, Muncy took the laws of the street seriously. Every rule, every myth.
"She looks skinny," Levi thought. "Skinnier than usual."
He sighed. He was so tired. In his body as much as his soul. It exhausted him, carrying all this guilt. If all his failures were at sea, then he was drowning, and the Omerta was the ball and chain dragging him down to rock bottom.
"Hello," Levi greeted them.
"Where were you last night?" Chez demanded. "Either of you?"
"Working, same as we both have every Saturday for the past year," Levi grunted.
Chez already knew this.
"Why? What did we miss?"
That was a question that, as the Iron Lord, he should never have had to ask.
"A run-in with the Skarhans,"
Muncy blurted. Her eyes shifted wildly from Levi to Chez.
"What?"
Levi growled. He would have never sanctioned such a brawl, nor would Raymond. But street law had more power than the Lord's in the end. Besides, Levi's history with Raymond wasn't common knowledge outside of this circle. The other Irons would view it as a breach of loyalty. Chez certainly did.
"Where was this?"
Jack asked sharply.
"Near Revolution Bridge."
"Not far from the border between Iron and Scarlands."
"Was anyone hurt?"
Levi asked, searching Muncy for scratches and bruises, but thankfully found none.
"One of our rats pulled a knife, but didn't get a chance to use it,"
Chez answered, his chest puffed out.
"Scavenger had it coming."
"Someone pulled a knife on Jonas."
Levi couldn't imagine which of his kids was that thick. Jonas was the deadliest agent in the Skarhans. He'd even killed a dove once.
"Well, Raymond'd be upset. Didn't mean to anger your missy, pup,"
Chez said, then instantly froze. Both Jack's and Muncy's mouths fell open. It took everything Levi had not to cringe, to remind himself that he didn't deserve this. He was meant for more than this. Levi slowly slid his knife out of his jacket. Not the smart one Vianca paid for, but the one with the rusted handle he'd used in the old days. Chez eyed the knife, but didn't move. Levi flipped it a few times in the air as he walked toward him, and the blade's edge twirled around Levi's fingers with deadly finesse. Chez wasn't the only one who could show off.
"It was a joke. You gonna gut me?"
Chez said it more like a dare than a question, but they both knew that this was more than that. 6 months ago, these comments were a joke. Now they were a threat. To Levi's power. To his pride. Levi didn't know how far he would go, but oh, that knife felt good in his hand. Raymond or Ivory would have never allowed their third to talk to them like that. but Levi had sworn long ago he wouldn't be like Raymond or Ivory. He wanted glory, not fear. Besides, it wasn't as if Levi could gut Chez, or simply kick him out. He'd need to replace him with someone else who could relay Levi's orders to the other Irons. Jack couldn't do all that himself. Muncie would run to the edge of the world and back for Levi, but she was only 13. How would it look if the third of the Irons was just a kid? The other gangs thought Levi was just a kid. If he made Muncie his third, they'd think he was a punchline. He hated to admit it, but he needed Chez, at least until he got Cedric his payment and could focus on the Irons again. Or maybe Chez would grow more tolerable after that. He used to be better, before he'd decided the Irons' problems were his responsibility, not Levi's. They'd been friends once. It all came back to respect in the end. Levi would rather earn his respect at the card table than demand it at gunpoint. But it was Raymond who had once told him that respect and fear were two sides of the same card. Since it had come this far, Levi needed to play his hand. He placed the edge of the blade against Chez's throat. Chez went rigid. He didn't dare to breathe. But he didn't fight back either. He didn't think Levi would truly hurt him. Levi barely recognized his own voice as he growled, "I could got you." Beside him, Muncie's eyes widened with uncertainty. It was a look Levi wouldn't soon forget.
"Oh, is that how you're playing now?" Chez rasped.
"The question is how you're playing," Levi hissed. "What makes a lord isn't the bravest, the smartest, or the first person to whip out a knife. It's the one who earns the vaults and keeps everyone alive. No one else can lead like me."
Levi felt the wisps of Jack's aura grazing his shoulder, as if trying to calm him. Jack probably didn't even realize his aura was doing it. Levi knew he wasn't acting like himself. The Iron Lord didn't have a reputation for pressing knives to his subordinates' throats. But this was the hand he'd been dealt. He didn't know how else to play it.
"The Irons have more vault floor than any other gang in New Reigns, thanks to me," Levi continued.
"Maybe once," Chez challenged. "Not anymore."
"This is temporary. Give me 9 days, and I'm going to solve all our problems."
Chez's eyebrows furrowed.
"What comes after 9 days?
"My freedom," Levi thought, although that wasn't entirely true. In 9 days, if he did manage to pay back Cedric, he'd be free of the investment scheme. But he'd never be free of Bianca. When all this was over, she'd just give him a new assignment, a new way to get himself killed and put vaults in her pocket. But maybe not. This was by far the worst job he'd ever done for her. She wouldn't demand such risk from him next time. He hated how much he was under her power, how he had to cling to the hope that next time she'd take pity on him, that next time she'd show compassion.
"You're a bitch,"
Raymond had said yesterday. He'd been joking. Raymond was always joking. But it had stung. Levi was, and always had been, the Iron Lord. And it was time that meant something again.
"Our paycheck comes after 9 days," Levi answered.
This wasn't a lie. Once the scheme was over, Levi could pay the Irons what the Irons were actually earning again. They were still the richest gang in the city, even if no one but him and Jack knew it.
"From now on," Levi commanded, dropping his knife and stepping back from Chez. "If you're thinking about pulling a knife on another gang, you clear it with me."
Chez's eyes narrowed. Levi could tell he was debating whether to challenge that order. Chez was coming awfully close to learning the truth of it, that Levi was stealing from his own gang. But it wasn't that simple, and Levi wouldn't do it if he didn't need to. He loved the Irons, but he wasn't sure he loved anything enough to die for it. Not when the problem was so close to vanishing. Much to Levi's relief, Chez nodded. Muncie nodded even more fervently, beaming with the kind of loyalty that made Levi's stomach hurt. He didn't deserve it. Only Jack failed to react. He was exceptionally grey and still and quiet. Even for him, it made Levi uneasy.
"Any other news to share?" Levi demanded. "Any questions?"
Chez shook his head.
"Then maybe we can get on with our meeting."
Levi pulled out the bag of orbs in his pocket and handed them out. As the third, Chez was responsible for distributing the shares to the other Ions. Chez didn't waste any time. He pulled his meter out of his pocket and counted the volts, as if Levi would sting his own crew to their faces.
"We need more," Chez said. "For the dealers taking more shifts. They're pulling extra weight, and they could use the vaults."
"We don't collect from the dens for a few more days," Levi said,
echoing the excuse he'd given Jack earlier.
"I would if I could."
He was tired of those words. Even if they were the truth, they felt like a lie. He could always do something more, give something else. Except this time he was truly out of options. Chez's eyes narrowed.
"There should be more. Where are the other vaults going? Where are the extra shares from last week?"
The extra shares were now in the white boot captain's pocket.
"There weren't any,"
Levi said, swallowing his guilt. "It's not supposed to be this way," he thought.
"But things are going to change," Levi swore. "Real soon. In fact, an opportunity has come up, and I have a favor to ask both of you because of it."
Muncy nodded enthusiastically, but Chez didn't respond. As always, he looked skeptical. Levi supposed Chez had little reason to believe him anymore. His word didn't hold much value these days, and Chez needed more than promises from him. He needed action.
"I'm looking for information about someone called Lords Alfaro."
"The one the missy yesterday was talking about?"
Muncy asked.
"Yeah, but you need to be on the low about it. People will be after Alfaro, I think, if they haven't already found her."
It was a dangerous favor to ask, which was why he didn't add that Lords was a monarchist. He didn't intend for Chez or Muncy to go digging and leave an incriminating trail. Lords was well known, but only in a few circles, nothing that would have touched the Irons. The less they knew, the better. He turned to Muncy.
"I also need your help tonight."
"For what?"
she asked eagerly.
"I need you to help me sneak four people into the Sauterelle."
Muncy worked there as kitchen staff, as well as an amateur car dealer.
"Celebrating something?"
Chez asked, a slight sneer in his voice.
"A business meeting of sorts," Levi said.
Muncy nodded.
"I can do that. No problem. Who's going?"
"Me, Jack, that girl you met yesterday, and a friend."
Raymond. He couldn't say that in front of Chez. Tonight he'd make Muncy swear to keep it a secret. It wasn't fair to her, but Levi didn't have the luxury of playing fair.
"I'll even bet a hand or two at their tables. You should play too."
She beamed.
"I've been practicing. The boss says I could be as good as you someday."
"You could be even better."
Behind her, Chez glared. It was an empty glare, Levi thought. He suspected the truth, but he didn't know. Like Muncy, the Irons were loyal to him. And no matter what Chez told them, no matter how bad it got, they all needed to believe in him for 9 more days. He needed to believe it too. 9 more days. And he would fix this. N. N stared down an impossibly long hallway. The tiled floor, the alternating doors, and the stone columns all repeated the same pattern of black and white. She knew she was dreaming, but she couldn't wake up. Not until she found the right door. She turned the knob on a white door to her left, locked. She tried the black one beside it, and it clicked and swung open. Once she stepped across the threshold, she slipped back into her own mind from 4 months past, and entered a memory. She was in a wool coat. February. She didn't detest anything quite so much as she did February, even if it was her birthday month. She stomped through the snow. Look at her, stomping. Ladies were supposed to glide. A girl from her class passed by in a motor car whose two flags bore her family's crest. Anne froze and tried to make herself appear smaller. This really was a hideous wool coat. Perhaps if she didn't move, the girl wouldn't see her. The girl didn't. But to Anne, that was almost worse. The motor car drove away, and Lords was behind it, standing beneath the street lamp with a newspaper tucked under her arm, wearing her favorite crimson scarf. She smirked. She must have seen N stomping. Humph. Well, Lords might think it was amusing, but she didn't have her society entrance in a year. Besides, Lords didn't glide either. Her mother strode, the heels of her boots clicking rhythmically, deliberately. Not that Lords was a lady every day, like she had dressed this morning. Lords hugged her when N crossed the street, and despite N's worries a few moments ago, she instantly felt safer. Lords smelled like fresh ink, which meant she'd spent all morning writing letters to her friends in New Rains. Honestly, N didn't understand why Lords associated with them. Everyone knew they defined reputation by the amount of voltage one gambled away, or the number of mistresses one kept. They entered a nearby cafe and were instantly enveloped in the aroma of fresh bread. Lords and N shared a cheese pastry to start, as they always did when Lords visited on Thursdays. Lords ate delicately, her slender fingers easing the crust from the filling. N refrained from tearing at it and tried to mimic Lords' easy grace. "How are your classes?" Lords asked, sipping her tea. It was in that moment that N admired, as she had so many times before, how striking her mother was. Her blonde hair was as pale and thin as the thread spun from a silkworm, her features serious yet elegant, from her aquiline nose to her deep-set eyes. N considered her best quality to be her skin, free of freckles or blemishes of any kind, and surprisingly youthful despite her age. Lords had an effortless grace that N was convinced she'd never possess. No matter how many etiquette lessons she took, how many classes she spent walking with books upon her head, nothing in N's life had ever felt effortless. "They're horridly dull. Algebra is illogical. My history teacher's voice puts everyone to sleep. Madame Tensington threatens to strap a ruler to my back to keep my posture straight."
"Breathe, N. You'll impair your digestion," Lords laughed. "You know, I bet algebra isn't all that illogical."
"It is to me. Some days, if it were not for my 10 fingers, I don't know how I'd survive."
"Surviving with fewer than 10 fingers would be taxing indeed," she said solemnly.
Somehow, N still suspected she was joking. They picked at the last pieces of the pastry, or rather, N did. Lord seemed to have lost her appetite.
"I'm leaving for New Rains tomorrow," she said. "I have some business there."
"What business?" N wanted to ask, but she never did. She'd decided long ago that she didn't want to know.
"I'll be back before school finishes, of course."
N sighed. She didn't have many friends, so Lord's business trips typically meant months of loneliness. N would go home every weekend to an empty house.
"Be careful while I'm gone," Lord said seriously.
Though maybe Lord's was the one who should have been careful. N had heard some appalling stories about the City of Sin.
"If I'm not back in 2 months, I'm dead."
N stiffened, even though Lords had given that warning before.
"Don't be so dreadful."
Then the memory deviated from what had actually happened, and the dream took over.
"I don't want you to go,"
N whispered. In that moment, she was no longer the same person from last February. She was present N, the one who'd spent a day in New Rains, who knew what the future held.
"Please don't go."
Her voice was stronger this time. Lord shushed her.
"I have to go."
"Why?"
N demanded.
"What could be so important? You're the only person who matters in my life. What else is out there that matters to you, that is so dangerous?"
She grasped for Lord's hands, but Lord's leaned back in shock.
"Why do you keep secrets from me?"
Hot tears sprang from her eyes.
"Why didn't you tell me the truth about what you do?"
The black door opened to the hallway, suddenly, forcefully, and evicted N from her memory. She landed painfully on the black and white floor tiles, and the door slammed in her face. She cried out for Lords, but woke up before she heard a response. Her sheets were damp with sweat. She rolled over and gazed out her bedroom window, where the sunrise illuminated the stunning view of the trash collectors in the alleys behind St. Morse. N waited for the details of her dream to fade. But even as she rose and readied herself for another day in the City of Sin, they never did. The St. Maur's acrobatics troupe huddled in a back hallway, bags slung over their shoulders, coffee in their hands, waiting for N. She was over 10 minutes late. In her defense, the parcel Vianca's staff left at N's door had come only with a leotard, not directions, and every opulent hallway in St. Maur's looked the same. The troop stared at her as she approached. N might have looked like an acrobat, with her small build and wide shoulders, but she wouldn't fool them for long. So she'd decided to be honest. She couldn't have been the only one without any experience, and acrobats' talents weren't common. Vianca had already hired her. Certainly they'd be willing to teach her.
"You must be N. Salter."
A young man shook her hand, his grip firm to the point of hurting.
"The dancer," he sneered.
She withered. "Hello," she said, mimicking the way people spoke here. He ignored her.
"Everyone, this is N, the replacement."
"Replacement?" she echoed.
"Last week a girl broke her leg and quit."
He looked her over.
"Clearly Vianca had to make do on short notice. Do you have any experience?"
"No," she answered weakly.
"Neither did the last girl."
He shook his head.
"We have a week until our next performance. Try not to break anything."
An acrobat, N seethed. What was Levi thinking? Now that the troupe was complete at 20 people, they walked out the back doors into an alley behind the casino. N crept quietly to the back of the line. The cool morning breeze teased pieces of her hair out of her neatly coiffed bun, and she shivered. New reins didn't seem to understand the concept of summer. Past several garbage bins, reeking and still awaiting the morning collectors, they reached the doors to a warehouse. It was no warmer inside, and it smelled of feet. The troop dumped their belongings in the corner of a massive square mat. There was equipment sprawled all around the warehouse, sets of bars, trampolines, and even a full flying trapeze. She craned her neck and stared at it, her palms growing sweaty. She hated heights. They spent over a half hour stretching, and no one said a word to her. She didn't mind. She was accustomed to that treatment from school. The warm-up and the leotard felt familiar, normal, and she missed her dancing classes back home. She'd never been the best dancer in the room, but at least she'd been confident in her abilities. Today she'd consider it a victory if she left with all her bones intact. After a while, the troupe split into groups. N lingered on the mat, awkward and alone, until a girl approached her. She was several years older than N, with blonde hair and freckles covering her face and arms.
"I'm Alice. I write the routines."
N shook her hand.
"I get to spend the week rushing you through the choreography."
If she didn't want to make a total fool of herself and the troupe, Alice explained, N would need to manage a single back handspring and brave the flying trapeze. Alice had cut N's part down to the most basic material, and unless N also fractured a limb, she would be performing the number next Saturday with the rest of them. N nodded along, feigning determination instead of fear. All she needed was to survive today's rehearsal so she could go to the Sauterelle tonight to find information on Lourdes. One day at a time. While Alice explained the different roles of each of the troupe members, N found herself imagining what it would be like to encounter her mother tonight. To spot her sitting at a table in the corner, smoking one of her foul cigarettes, a newspaper and a glass of bourbon in front of her. What would Lourdes say about finding N at the same cabaret? "I'm sorry. I was running late, that's all," Lourdes would apologize, her voice as soothing as the sound of rain on rooftops. "There wasn't any need to worry." And what would Lourdes say when she realized how quickly the city had corrupted her daughter? N had poisoned Cedric Torin. She was a prisoner to the unbreakable chains of a cruel mafia donna. Her only ally was a street lord. N couldn't come up with any answers. She had no idea what Lourdes would say. As it turned out, she didn't know much about Lourdes at all.
"We'll start with the worst of it," Alice declared, her speech finished. "Once that group is done,
N realized with horror that she meant they'd begin with the flying trapeze. N studied the group of four rehearsing there. They soared effortlessly, fearlessly, even though they were at least 50 feet off the ground. Of course there was a net between them and a broken back, but it looked thick and stiff. Falling into it couldn't be much more comfortable than hitting the floor. N swallowed as she followed Alice up the ladder, her legs wobbling worse with each rung.
"We don't always have the flying trapeze in the show," Alice said,
while N crawled unsteadily onto the platform.
"The guests like it. It looks impressive."
As she spoke, she reached for the rope, then reeled in the closest trapeze. She handed N the bar, and N's stomach leaped as she reached out for it.
"You won't have to worry about catches today, thankfully. There's nothing like that in your routine. But you need to be comfortable with the bar."
She raised her eyebrows as she examined N's face.
"I can already tell it's going to take you a while to be comfortable."
N reddened. "Dancing is generally done on the floor." Alice didn't look amused.
6 days, missy. It will be awfully embarrassing for the troupe if you break your legs in front of an audience."
N managed not to say anything unladylike, but she was certainly thinking about it. Alice continued her lesson plan, but N was barely listening. She felt ill, even as she fixed her gaze securely above the floor, locked only on the space in front of her.
"Go!"
Alice commanded. N took a deep breath, held the bar, and leaped. She lurched forward, and the world seemed to give out beneath her as she soared. As she went backward, she reached her toes out behind her for the platform, coming a few inches short. Her breath tightened in panic.
"That's not how gravity works, missy," Alice said.
N couldn't tell if it was amusement or annoyance in her voice.
"You'll need to give it some push if you intend to come back."
That would have been nice to know ahead of time, instead of when she dangled limply 50 feet above the ground. She desperately tried to avoid looking down. On her second return backward, Alice instructed again, more emphatically,
"Push!"
So N pushed. She kicked her legs behind her as she reached the peak, then brought them in front of her as she sped forward. Her body, much like the movement of the trapeze, was an arc. Her core ached from keeping her legs so straight, but it wasn't terribly difficult. She'd always been strong. After 2 swings, N had generated enough force to make it back to the platform. She exhaled shakily and tucked a loose strand of hair behind her ear. Alice pursed her lips.
"Your technique is very precise."
But her sour expression and complimentary words didn't seem to match.
"Much better than the last girl. Did it feel good?"
N nodded. She wouldn't mind doing it again, now that she wasn't so nervous. Alice relayed some more instructions.
"If you can lock your knees around it, or even sit up, I'll be really impressed."
N had always considered herself someone who rose to the occasion. After all, being from one of the lowest-tier dancing families at her school, every challenge was an opportunity to prove herself. This might not have been ballet, and this certainly was not her finishing school, but her familiar competitive drive began to take over. She leaped, this time more comfortable with her center of balance and with the trapeze. When she reached the highest point of the arc, she kicked her legs up, tucked them beneath her arms, and latched them onto the bar. As she let her hands go, a few memories from her childhood returned to her, of similar games played at parks, of cartwheels and swings, of tumbles and scraped knees, none of which she'd thought about in years. Lords had never approved, she recalled. As she glided, she almost had the urge to laugh. She didn't remember the last time she'd enjoyed herself like this. When N returned to the platform, she did so only to catch her breath. Alice handed her a cup of water, which N gratefully accepted.
"None of it's difficult, what you're doing, you know."
There was a strange edge to her voice.
"I'm not surprised you can do it, but it's your form that's more interesting. You sure you've never done this before?"
"No."
"You're quite the natural."
N had never been called natural at anything. Everything she was good at, she'd worked for. Everything she'd earned had been an uphill battle. Then N placed the edge in Alice's tone. She felt threatened.
"What's your split talent, missy?"
Alice asked.
"Counting." "You any good at it?"
She hesitated,
knowing what Alice was getting at.
No.
Well, maybe Mummy didn't really know the daddy after all, she said pointedly.
N glared at her.